much for hanging in there, and I'm going to start by reading a poem about me being a poet in New York City, and there goes my watch. Hold on a second. Otherwise, I'll go over here. And coming across a little bit of my past, because you think that you're doing poetry and you leave some things behind you, but sometimes it catches up to you anyway. Poem is called Meeting the Animal in Washington Square Park. The acrobats were out in Washington Square Park, flaying arms and colors, the jokers and breakdancers, the singers and mimes. I pulled out of a reading at New York City College and watched a crowd gather around a young man jumping over 10 garbage cans from a skateboard. Then out of the side of my eye, I saw someone who didn't seem to belong here, like I didn't belong. He was a big man, 6 feet and more, with tattoos on his arms, his back, his stomach, and neck. On his abdomen were the words in huge old English lettering, Hazard. I knew this guy. I knew that place. I looked closer. It had to be him. It was. Animal from East L.A., world heavyweight contender, the only Chicano from L.A. ever ranked in the top 10 of the division, the one who went toe-to-toe with Leon Spinks and even made Muhammad Ali look the other way. Animal, I yelled. Who the fuck are you, he asked. A quart of beer in his grasp, eyes squinting. My name's Louis from East L.A., he brightened. East L.A., here in Washington Square Park, man, we everywhere. The proverbial what part of East L.A. came next, but I gave him a shock. From La Garrity, I said, that's the mortal enemies of the Big Hazard gang. I should kill you, Animal replied. Hey, if we were in L.A., I suppose you would, but we in New York City, man. I should kill you anyway. Instead, he thrust out his hand with the beer and offered me a drink. We talked about what had happened since he stopped fighting, about the time I saw him at the Cleveland House boxing arena looking over some up-and-coming fighters, how he had been to prison, joined a prison gang, how he ended up homeless in New York City with a couple of kids somewhere. And there he was with a mortal enemy from East L.A. talking away. I told him how I was now a poet doing a reading at City College, and he didn't wince or look absurd at me. Seemed natural. Sure, a poet from East L.A. That's the way it should be. Poet and boxer, drinking beer, among the homeless, the tourists, and acrobats, mortal enemies. When I told him I had to leave, he said, go then, but soon shook my hand East L.A. style and walked off. Maybe someday you'll do a poem about me, eh? Sure, Animal, that sounds great. Someday I'll do a poem about you. Thank you. For the next few minutes, I want to just cover a little bit of ground of some of my experiences and some of my poems. And I'm going to start with the Tia Chucha poem, because my press in Chicago is named Tia Chucha Press. And I named it, for those who don't know what Tia Chucha would mean. It means my aunt Chucha, Jesusita, who we called her Tia Chucha. How many of you have a crazy relative in your family? And I think some of you are the crazy relative, right? Yeah. Well, she was the crazy relative. She was the one that everybody talked bad about, who never got married, you know, didn't like the church. But she was so creative. She would always have a guitar in her back, poems, songs. She would have to move from one family household to another because after a while they'd want to kick her out, so then she'd move out before they actually got rid of her. But I really loved her, and this is the poem for my Tia Chucha. Every few years, Tia Chucha would visit the family in a tornado of song and open us up as if we were an overripe avocado. She was a dumpy, black-haired creature of upheaval who often came unannounced with a bag of presents, including homemade perfumes and colognes that smelled something like rotting fish on a hot day at the tuna cannery. They said she was crazy. Oh, sure. She once ran out naked to catch the postman with a letter that didn't belong to us. I mean, she had this annoying habit of boarding city buses and singing at the top of her voice. One bus driver even refused to go on until she got off. But crazy? To me, she was the wisp of the wind's freedom, a music maker who once tried to teach me guitar but ended up singing and singing, me listening and her singing until I put the instrument down and watched the clock click the lesson time away. I didn't learn guitar, but I learned something about her craving for the new, the unbroken, so she could break it. Periodically, she banished herself from the family and was the better for it. I secretly admired Tia Chucha. She was always quick with a story. Another Pepito joke, and for those who don't know what Pepito jokes are, I'll tell you later. Or a handwritten lyric that she would produce regardless of the occasion. She was a despot of desire, uncontainable as a splash of water on a varnished table. I wanted to remove the layers of a natural scene, the way Tia Chucha beheld the world with first eyes like an infant who can discern the elixir within milk. I wanted to be one of the prizes she stuffed into her rumpled bag. Thank you. The journey is not going to go in any particular linear direction. It's just going to go back and forth. And what I want to do is touch a little bit upon what my book, Always Running, is about, the gang life. But this has to do with the sniffing, the spray that a lot of the kids in the body would do, because besides all the heroin and everything people try to do, it was easy. You could steal it. You know, it was always available. And it gave you the craziest high. And one of the things that I'm doing now is I'm going through Latin America. I've just been through Central America. I went to Mexico. I might be going to Colombia to observe or deal with the glue sniffers across the Americas. You know, 7, 6, 8-year-old kids who are living off glue. And I wanted to do this because it seems to be something that tied me up when I was in East LA and we were doing it. It kind of links us. So this is a poem that I wrote about a near-death experience I went through on the spray. It's called The Concrete River. I know people said the book with the concrete poems is actually The Concrete River. And I need to explain it because unlike all these cities like St. Louis with the river right there, you can actually have water. The LA River is concrete. It only is water when it rains and it floods and then... But after that, it's nothing but concrete. But that's where we hung out. That's where we played and got drunk and made love, got into fights, and it was our playground. So this poem is called The Concrete River. We sink into the dust, Baba and me, beneath brush of prickly leaves, ivy strangling trees, singing our last rites of locura. Homeboys worshiping God fumes out of spray cans. Our backs press up against a corrugated steel fence along the dried banks of a concrete river. Spray-painted outpourings on walls offer a chaos of color for the eyes. Home for now, hidden in weeds, furnished with stained mattresses and plastic milk crates. Wood planks thrust into thick branches serve as roof. The door is a torn cloth curtain knocked before entering. Home for now. Sandwiched in between the maddening days. We aim spray into paper bags, suckle them, take deep breaths, an echo steel sounds grates the sky. Home for now, along an urban spawn stream of muck, we gargle in the technicolor synthesized madness. This river, this concrete river, becomes a steaming, bubbling snake of water, pouring over nightmares of wakefulness, pouring out a rush of birds, a flow of clear liquid on a cloudless day. Not like the black oil stains we lie in. Not like the factory air engulfing us. Not this plastic death in a can. Sun rays dance in the surface. Gray fish fidget below the sheen. And us looking like Huckleberry Finns, Tom Sawyers with stick fishing poles as dew drips off low branches as if it were Earth's breast milk. Oh, we should be Noahs of our born days. We should be scraping wet dirt with calloused toes. We should be flowering petals playing ball. Soon water fish do wane into a pulsating whiteness. I enter eternal circles, swimming to a glare of lights. Family and friends beckon me. I want to be there, in perpetual dreaming. In the den of exquisite screams, I want to know this mother comfort surging through me. I am a sliver of blazing ember entering a womb of brightness. I am a hovering specter shedding scarred flesh. I am a clown sneaking out of a painted mouth in the sky. I am your son, Ama, seeking the security of shadows, fleeing worries, eyes bursting brown behind a sewing machine. I am your brother, the one you threw off rooftops, tore into with rage, the one you visited a rag of a boy lying in a hospital bed, ruptured. I am friend of books, prey of cops, lover of the body of women selling hamburgers and tacos at the P&G burger stand. I welcome this heavy shroud. I want to be buried in it, to be sculptured marble and craftier hands. Soon an electrified hum sinks teeth into brain, then claws surround me, pull at me, back to the dust, to the concrete river. Let me go. To stay entangled in this mesh of barbed serenity, but over me is a face, mouth, breathing back life. I feel the gush of air, the pebbles and debris beneath me. Give me the bag, man, I slur. No way, you died, man, Baba said. You stopped breathing and died. I have to go back, you don't understand. I try to get up, to reach the sky. Oh, for the lights, for this horror of a sun to blind me, to entice me to burn. Come back. Let me swing in the delight to the haunting nail, to pierce colors of virgin skies. Not here along a concrete river, but there licked by tongues of flame. When I went
to the shelter this morning, I did mention a few of the things that I'd done as a young boy. But one of the things was being homeless as a teenager in the streets of L.A. and going down downtown a lot because they used to have these all-night movie theaters. I think they were 75 cents, 50 cents. And you would just spend all night with the winos, you know, and kind of like wait till the morning comes. And then the ushers would throw you out into the sunlight Of course, it was really nice because the office girls would be going to work, and it seemed like a good life to me. I thought it was great, you know, just had it made. But if you ever you are homeless, because we slept in vacant lots, slept in alleys, cars, abandoned cars, wherever we could, you always come across the police. And so I have this poem called Chota, because this is what we call them, Chota. Here I lie. Embraced by the miasmic draft of side street America, a voice cuts into the still air. A police officer stands above me and the gum stains on 7th Street. Chota. Soon I sit battered, humiliated in the dankness of a jail cell. Officers wallow around contemplating my suicide. But this time, they will have to kill me. Each time a fist smashes across my belly, pummels my face, I reach out to the cries of the curb, the ballads out of broken brick, and the smoky outline of a woman's face burned onto a cell wall. They will have to kill me. I want to read a poem on a lighter note. It has to do with roosters and chickens because Mexicans, when they came over, they tend to have brought their chickens and roosters with them. And in the part of the east side of LA that I lived in, they had the backyards and the coops, and they had the fighting roosters. So they were real precious because you can make money. You can have the fighting cocks. And I hated them. And we used to sneak in there and shoot BBs at them. It's terrible to say now because people were really upset about this. But I just didn't like chickens and roosters. They were too noisy. They stunk. And I really thought when I moved to Chicago, I'd finally get away from these damn chickens and roosters. I did. Because here's a three-story
you know, concrete city, right? You know, three-story flats, you know, and you think. And, of course, I moved into this Puerto Rican neighborhood, and guess what? That's right. Chickens and roosters everywhere. Not only that, in the hallways, in the apartment buildings, they'd be walking down the hallways. So since I figured I couldn't leave them, I might as well write about them. And I have a poem about an Istale rooster that used to drive me up the wall. And this poem is called "The Rooster Who Thought It Was a Dog." Echo Park mornings came on the wings of a rooster's gnawing squawk. This noise, unfortunately, also brought in the afternoon, evenings, and most hours of the day. The rooster had no sense of time, nor any desire to commit to one. He'd cock-a-doodle whenever he had the notion. For late sleepers, day sleepers, or your plain, ordinary, run-of-the-mill night sleepers, annoyance had this rooster's beak. It was enough to drive one nuts. Often I opened my back window that faced the alley just across from the backyard where the rooster made his home. "Shut up or I'll blow your stinking brains out," I'd yell. Great communication technique. It worked on the brats next door, but the rooster never flinched. With calm aplomb, it continued to squawk. For one thing, the rooster never gave out a bona fide cock-a-doodle. It sort of shouted it out. It happened that the rooster lived with three dogs, a German Shepherd and two mutts. The dogs barked through their existence. They barked at everything in sight. I finally concluded that rooster thought it was a dog. Somehow I didn't mind the dogs barking, but when a rooster barks, that's murder. In fact, I often saw it running alongside the dogs as they raced across the dirt yard, barking at passing cars and people. If the dogs went left, the rooster went left. They'd go right, and dang if the rooster didn't go right as well. Now, I don't know if this is a regular condition for roosters. I thought I had a story for the Weekly World News. I could see it now, the rooster who thinks it's a dog. Who knows what rooster dementia we had here? And whether the rooster chased cats up trees or pissed on fire hydrants, this wasn't clear. But once I grasped the heart of the matter, I began to see the rooster in another light. I felt sorry for this fowl with an identity problem. And I wondered how it must react when its owners threw chicken bones to the dogs. Would it nibble on the remains of its favorite hen? I shuddered at the thought. Yet, despite the revelation of the rooster's bark, the problem of sleep didn't end. Then one day, a new neighbor, a young lady who often drank herself to bliss, got a gun and blew the rooster away. She became somewhat of a local hero. I must say, though, it was an unfitting end for the bird. But I suppose one can tolerate barking dogs. But barking roosters, that's another matter altogether. I'm going to read you a poem. One of the things that happened when I did go to Chicago is I discovered that great poetry scene there. And, of course, it's all over the country and the Midwest. But when I got there about 9 years ago, and there was the poetry slams were starting. And the people were doing all this open mic everywhere, and all the bars and all the cafes were doing the readings. And I would go every night to a bar and a cafe and hear the readings. And finally, I would have the courage to get up and start talking on the mic. At first, I thought the people from Chicago would tell me, "Go back to L.A., you know, get out of here." But it turned out that they really loved and they embraced my work, and it turned out to be a very good thing. One of the things about, I know you know this, but one of the things about being in these open mics is that you end up having to hear, like, so-so and some really bad poems, but then every once in a while you get a poem that just knocks you off your butt, you know, just really gets to you. And that's almost worth the wait. It's almost worth all the beers and everything waiting for that one poem to kind of grab you. So I met Patricia Smith, who I'm sure some of you are familiar with now. She's now in Boston, and Theatrucha Press, we published her first book. She's gotten all over the place. She's now the National Poetry Slam champion. But I met her when she was starting out, just like me, in the bars. And she read it and really, really got to me. So this poem is for Patricia Smith, and it's called "Don't Read That Poem." She rises from a chair and slides toward the stage with satin feet over a worn wood floor.
She bears down on the microphone like a blues singer about to reveal some secrets, a fever of poems in her hand. She seizes the mic and begins her seduction. I'm in the back of the bar, my head down. The things she does to me with words. I want to leave. I want her never to begin. She starts with a poem about daddy love, and I feel like getting up right there and yelling, "Don't read that poem." The one that causes little bursts of screams inside my head, that makes tears come to my eyes that I refuse to let fall. Don't read that poem, the one about a daughter raped and killed in the shadow of a second's dark fury. I want to hide in the neon glare above me, to swim away in the glass of beer I hold close to me. She does another poem about her many mouths, and I want to howl. Don't read that poem, the one that entices me to crawl under her skin to be her heartbeat. Oh, how she plucks the right notes, rendering me as clay in bruised hands. No, don't do the one about what it is to be a 9-year-old black girl, the truth of it trembling at my feet. Somebody should make her stop. I should be home watching TV, blank-eyed behind stale headlines, cold popcorn on the couch, a dusty turntable going round and round and round. I should be fixing a car or shooting 8-ball, but I can't leave. I need to taste the salt of her soliloquy, to be drunk with the sobriety of her verse quaking beneath my eyelids.
For the last 4 years, I've been working with homeless people in Chicago and in other cities now. We started all these homeless workshops, poetry workshops. I did one six-week program with this women's shelter, Irene's Place, but it's a kind of a thing that after I got going 6 weeks, we just got to build a relationship. So I've been there for 4 years, and I haven't been able to let them go, and they won't let me go. And we started publishing their work. And so I went to L.A., Denver, other cities, and did shelters among homeless. I mean, did poetry workshops among homeless people in the streets as well as in the shelters. And we in L.A., there was a homeless art festival, and we had all these homeless people get up and do poetry. It was very beautiful, very beautiful stuff. One of the guys I met there, though, was a Mexican immigrant who was homeless there in the streets, and he told me this story about how he kept wondering who this guy Jesus Chavez was. Seemed like to be a famous guy, because every time he looked around, there was a big sign, Jesus Chavez, Jesus Chavez. And he says, this guy must be a pretty big deal here, you know. And I thought that was a great beginning for a poem. That was a great poem. And so what I decided to do is to do this poem in his voice and do it like if it was him. But one thing that happened is my daughter, she's such a great critic that she says, Dad, you start this poem in one way and then you end it in another way. And that really blew me away. She says, God darn it, I didn't know I did that. But it's good to have other people who could find this out. So anyway, it starts in one way and it ends in another way. But it's about this guy and Jesus Salves, or Jesus Saves. This dude, Jesus Salves, must be popular or something. You see his name everywhere. I first saw it when I woke up from a Bunker Hill cardboard box to a huge sign at the top of the L.A. library. It read, Jesus Salves. I wish I were that guy. Then I wouldn't be this chalked-faced pirate on city seas, the starved acrobat of the alcoves loitering against splintered doors. Then I wouldn't be this aberration who once had a home made of stone even and a woman to call wife. In the old country I worked since I was 7, I knew the meaning of the sun's behest for poor to weep. But now such toil is allowed to rot like too many berries on a bush. In the old country, I laughed the loudest, made the most incisive remarks, and held at bay even the most limpid of gatherings. But here, I am a grieving poet, a scavenger of useless literature. They mean nothing in this place. My metaphoric manner, the spectacle of my viscous verse, nothing. I am but a shadow on the sidewalk, a spot of soot on a block wall,
A roll of dice tossed across a collapsing hallway in a downtown SRO hotel. Okay, Senor Chavez, right now this is your time. But someday a billboard will proclaim my existence. Someday people will sigh my name as if it were confection on the lips. As long as I have a rhythm in my breast, there will come this fine day when this orphan pregnant with genius is discovered sprouting epiphanies like wings on the doorstep of mother civilization. Of course, in my work with the homeless, I have found nothing but epiphanies and wings and beautiful works come out. And it's still a battle with some people who don't believe that homeless people can do poetry, believe it or not. There was a big engagement with me about it in the newspaper there where people wrote and said, how dare Luis Rodriguez do poetry in homeless shelters? These aren't poets. They can't be poets. And we had an ongoing writing battle, and it actually got into Poets and Writers magazine, which was okay because it meant that I could really stand up and deal with this issue. But I'm going to read you a poem then that I wrote for the homeless. It's called A Harvest of Eyes. A street finds its song in the murmur of a woman's heart as she lies on a sidewalk. Conversations in concrete promise nothing. The rustling of vines along an unkept lawn is a man finding a place to sleep. The ruin of hype is in the lined face of a former carpenter here among a harvest of eyes uttering truth in liquid voices. Eyes like multicolored pearls submerged beneath tears frozen by wind. They are wondrous spheres simmering with a faint sparkle, smoldering with pain yet distant. The distance between cracks on cement, the distance of a layoff slip, the distance of the hungry next to the fed. You hate them, you pity them, don't get near them. The geography of politics. Here is a war veteran, a father of wiry boys whose auto plant job crumbled after 18 years of service. Look deeply. See yourself in the jagged lines of a severed America. Where once the tilled stalks of wheat watercolored the horizons. Where once steel reigned amid the toppled timbers. Where a homecoming queen could stand tall on a platform, a proud papa at her side, and have it mean something. Not this occupied corner in a carnival of neon shadows on fractured walls. Not this bristling yield of eyes like ripened fruit ready to be plucked. Thank you. I want to share with you, I guess, a couple of kind of fairly angry poems. And it has to do with the fact that my book was written for my son who joined a gang when he was 15 years old in Chicago. To give him the benefit, I suppose, of what I went through, of what I survived. But I have taken a very controversial position on the gangs because it's true that I don't see them as problems in these communities, but in many ways as solutions when there's no other options. Young people finding their fellowship, a place to belong. I know why I joined a gang. But I also know why we became destructive. And it didn't come from within us. It came from all the you know, like I tell people, you know, there's all these barriers to educational advancement, to finding a job, to getting your life together, but no barriers to getting the gun, to taking the drugs and shooting people. There's none, not even prison, because prison is not a barrier for that. And there's a lot of reasons why people do what they got to do, but I also believe that the answer lies within the young people themselves, their own strength and their own power. And because I don't really think that they're about destruction, and they really are about change. My son began to change tremendously when the book was written. He read it. I know it changed his life, and he went with me to speak out, and he called it a mission. It wasn't a book. So this is a mission. Against the polemicizing against the prisons, polemicizing against three strikes you're out, polemicizing against zero tolerance, polemicizing against all these people who don't want these young people to be creative, don't want them in their face, they want to get rid of them. Because to me, the future is there with them. But we don't got a world for them. What are they inheriting?
They have to create their own world, and nobody's there to really guide them through it. And then we dump on them because we don't like the world they're trying to create. So my son has been very strong and powerful, and I'm very proud of him. He's going to be 19 this year. He himself has a year-old son, which has kind of helped him mature, believe it or not, and wanting to be a real father for his own boy. Unfortunately, last June, he got beat up by the police because there's a lot of forces that won't let you transcend, won't let you try to overcome. He got beat up really bad. He looked like Ronnie Keane. I mean, we had pictures of him, you know, all knocked and beat up, and we'll try to see if we can do a civil suit and other things around this. I haven't finished that poem, but I do have another poem related to it. The very first place that me and my son went when we started promoting the book was a radio station in Chicago. And it was supposed to be me, my son, Ramiro, his name is Ramiro, and a police officer. And when the police officer heard that we were going to be on the station, he refused to sit in the same room as us. And actually went outside and made his call and got his 15 minutes in the air, and then we got to talk. And so I wrote this poem in anger about the situation. It's called, "To the Police Officer Who Refused to Sit in the Same Room as My Son Because He's a Gangbanger. How dare you? How dare you pull this mantle from your sloven sleeve and think it worthy enough to cover my boy? How dare you judge when you also wallow in this mud? Somebody has turned over society's power to you, relinquishing its rule, turned it over to the man in the mask whose face never changes, always distorts, who does not live where I live but commands the corners, who does not have to wait the nightmares, the street chants, the bullets, the early morning calls, but looks over at us and demeans, calls us animals not worthy of his presence. And I have to say, how dare you? My son deserves to live as all young people. He deserves a future and a job. He deserves contemplation. I can't turn away as you, yet you govern us. Hear my son's talk. Hear his plea within his pronouncement, his cry from the crevices of his hard words. He speaks in two voices, one of a boy, the other of a man. One is breaking through, the other just hangs. Listen, you who can turn away, who can make such a choice, you who have sons of your own but do not hear them. My son has a face too dark, features too foreign, a tongue too tangled, yet he reveals, he truths, he sings your demented rage, but he sings. You have nothing to rage because it is outside of you. He is inside of me. His horror is mine. I see what he sees. And if my son dreams, if he plays, if he smiles through the mist, the moon glow, there I will be, smiling through the blackened, cluttered, and snarling pathway toward your shriveled heart." I have to do this other poem because there's a related situation. When he got beat up, I ended up the next day having to do a poetry reading at the Chicago Poetry Festival. And I was very pissed off. And when I got up to read, I was really angry, and I read this poem. This is a poem that I wrote for President Clinton that The Nation published. It's an inaugural poem. You know, after Maya Angelou, she did a poem, so The Nation invited some poets to write something, and this is what I wrote for him, to him. And it's called The Facts of Life. And what happened, however, is the next issue of the Letter X, which is the Chicago Poetry magazine, they attacked me for being unpatriotic, for daring to attack America and the privilege that we have living here. Of course, I was looking at what privilege? What are you talking about, you know? But still, I think the poem speaks for itself, and you can judge for yourself whether it's unpatriotic. For my country, it is very patriotic. "Let me tell you the facts of life from beneath the tattered coat of my country. This country whose soul has died long before the body.
This country which is blurry-eyed from lack of dreaming, yet full of sleep. This country which is inebriated with guilt and false grinning. This country which is a beggar's song slithering through city veins. This country which is night pouring over the crevices on the face of day. This country of laughter and illumination across the ocean of lies where we drown. This country of winter's breath gusting across a swollen star-spangled sky. This country which dances without a beat. In constant searching, constant rupturing. This country with seeds that is hungry and limps with ambiguity. This country saturated with sweet odors and colors, yet stitched and scrawled with race hatred. This country where the road from hope to hope must pass beyond expectation, beyond class privilege. This country whose penitence is waiting at the corner of fury and fire. This country where every promise must be rendered, every dream made flesh. This country where all that's left is to act. And my country will act if you won't. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you.